Support for this program is provided by Chevron, the human energy company.
Hey, this is Politico Energy. I'm Catherine Morehouse. It feels like extreme weather is driving the Texas power grid to the top of the news cycle a lot these days, and it's becoming an increasingly divisive entity on the Hill. Texas is seeing hotter and hotter summers, including this one, and that is testing the state's power system. Winter months are not much better. Just 3 years ago, electricity infrastructure froze across the state, forcing millions of people to go without heat or power. Meanwhile, demand is only expected to grow in Texas as data centers and manufacturing hubs come streaming in. This combination of more demand and extreme weather events is sparking calls from Democrats on Capitol Hill, who say that Texas should connect to the broader American power system. But Republicans in the state strongly disagree and are calling instead for more fossil fuel plants. So today, I sit down with the person at the center of all of this, the CEO of the Texas Power Grid, Pablo Vegas. He runs the Electricity Council of Texas, also known as ERCOT. I talk with him about how Texas is preparing for extreme weather events and what he thinks about the partisan fighting over the system. Here's our extended conversation. It's Tuesday, May 28th. Pablo Vegas, it is so good to see you again, and thank you for joining the Politico Energy podcast. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thanks so much, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and it's great to talk to you again.
I wanted to jump in with kind of an explanation of the Texas grid and why it's a unique system. There's been some debate in recent years, particularly following the winter storm, about whether Texas should join the wider U.S. power system. And before we get into that debate, I was wondering if you could first explain how the Texas grid is unique and why it is the way that it is. Why is it separate from the rest of the U.S. power system?
So we are unique animals. So the ERCOT grid, we serve about 26 million Texans through ERCOT. We are kind of an electrical island that has a couple of connection points into other parts of the U.S. grid. Those connection points, we call them DC ties. They are closed and then have to be scheduled and opened in order to let electricity flow. But it's a relatively limited amount, a little over 1,000 megawatts of transfer capability during or through those ties relative to a grid that at peak is about 85,000 megawatts. We are a summer peaking grid. So we hit our biggest peak last August at about 85,000 megawatts. But we see some pretty significant winter peaks as well. Just this Martin Luther King week in January, we hit almost 79,000 megawatts, just south of that. So incredible growth. One thing that has characterized the ERCOT grid over the last 15 years has been very strong electric growth in comparison to a lot of other parts of the United States. We've seen electrification starting to take off, renationalization of manufacturing, and a lot of that manufacturing coming to Texas. And then, of course, the growth in data centers, crypto mining, all of that is spurring the demand for electricity, in addition to just the traditional strong migration that Texas has been experiencing over the last few years. And then one of the other characteristics of the ERCOT grid that's somewhat unique is the very significant amount of renewables that have developed here in Texas over the last 15 years. So we are the nation's leader in wind energy right now, with around 40,000 megawatts of wind capacity on the system, around number two for the amount of solar available on the grid, as well as the amount of battery storage that has developed here. That also creates some pretty unique challenges for a grid operator, balancing the intermittency of those types of resources and making sure that we can always deliver reliability for such a dynamic and rapidly growing grid.
Well, you've given me a ton to dig into, but I want to start with this recent push by primarily Democratic lawmakers for Texas to strengthen its tie beyond what you describe with the wider U.S. grid. I'm wondering what your stance is on that push and how you think about that.
So let's break it into kind of two kind of components. There's one way to connect a grid that would be considered a synchronous connection, meaning it's real-time connected all the time. And that is how elements all across the eastern part of the U.S. and the western part of the U.S. are connected to each other. That has very different implications in Texas. If we were to synchronously connect ERCOT to the rest of the United States, we would be developing quite a lot of transmission lines to be able to support that. And so it's a very high cost to do that. And secondary, there is then opens up the question of jurisdiction over the ERCOT power markets. Today, because ERCOT is an electric island, it is not under the wholesale power jurisdiction of FERC. It is under the power jurisdiction of the Texas State Legislature and the Public Utility Commission of Texas. If we were to be synchronously connected to the rest of the U.S., that would likely fall under FERC jurisdiction, and the timetables for making changes in wholesale power markets at the federal level are significantly slower than what we experience in Texas. That's one pathway. The other pathway to connect it further is using DC ties. And as I mentioned, we already have a small number of those. And frankly, there's really no, I think, opposition to the consideration of DC ties because, one, it shouldn't affect any of the jurisdictional questions. The questions that really need to be explored around DC ties is severalfold. One, the cost of them. They're very costly to develop. So you would need to evaluate the cost of that against the benefit you would get. So the obvious benefits could be reliability during large regional weather events, resiliency potential if you had a loss of service in one side or the other. You also need to look at the fact that when you have large weather events like a winter storm Uri, during the more severe periods of that storm, there really wasn't a lot of excess capacity that could have flowed into Texas to support what was going on in this part of the region. And then I'd say the last thing that's really important to look at is the impact on the markets. Because when you interconnect regions, you're going to have a change in the market dynamics for the price of power and the price of transmission capacity. And are those changes going to flow into Texas, out of Texas, and under what conditions? And so who benefits from these types of connections? Those are some complex models that would have to be developed. And that's something that, again, we'd have to look into and evaluate specifically to see if it makes sense to further develop those kinds of ties.
It sounds like it's a very nuanced and complicated problem, and perhaps more concerns over the federal jurisdiction piece and some openness on the DC ties piece. And one of the interesting things about this debate in recent years is it feels like it's become really partisan. It was a big issue during the state governor's race, for instance. Why do you think that is, that something so nuanced and complicated and obscure as Texas's grid connections has become such a flashpoint politically?
Well, unfortunately, I think we've seen the politicization of so many facets of the electric industry, whether it is ideologies around renewables. There seems to be some perception that renewables are a liberal ideology element versus a conservative ideology element. And to me, that doesn't really make sense because all of the types of resources that serve the electric grid have different attributes. And those are the things that are important about it, not the political alignment for it. So I think those that are close to the industry understand renewables have an important role to play. So do traditional thermal dispatchable resources like coal plants or nuclear plants. If you look at batteries, all of those resources play an important part in terms of contributing something to the electric grid. So it's really not a Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal kind of an issue. It's really around how do you embrace all of these attributes and make them work more effectively. But that being said, I recognize that a lot of people put themselves in one bucket or the other, so it becomes political. And when you look at the interconnection question, there's a lot of, I'd say, Texas pride to Texas having the ownership of their electric system, having control over what happens with that electric system. And so Texas has historically had a more conservative stance in the political federal landscape. And so it all of a sudden becomes attributed to a conservative stance, you know, that it's a conservative ideology that would keep Texas separated, rather than looking at the substance of it, meaning what are the benefits that ERCOT participants get by being an island grid versus what they would have to give up if they were going to be part of a federal power system. So I really think it's more important to focus on those attributes, and hopefully we can cut through some of the politics and get to meaningful and substantive discussions that get to really good answers on really important questions, like how do we improve resource adequacy and reliability in a fast-growing economy with fast-growing renewable resources and battery resources and the such.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting when you talk about the debate over renewables, for instance. That was obviously something that came up very strongly after the winter storm. There was this huge backlash against wind and solar resources in particular. And I mean, as you can tell me better than anyone, it was obviously, again, complicated problem with the wide mix of reasons. Can you talk through why you think renewables got such a big backlash during that storm?
Well, I mean, when you looked at the raw numbers of the resources on the grid that were providing power during Winter Storm Uri, you could look at the numbers coming from the renewable resources and say, wow, there was a really low output from renewable resources during that period of time. The important factor around that lower output is that it was expected to be lower. So the grid operator, ERCOT, had an expectation that there wasn't going to be a lot of wind output because of how cold it was going to be, and the recognition that during extreme cold, icy events, windmills tend to freeze up and they don't produce a lot of power. So we knew that that was likely going to happen. What wasn't known that was going to happen was the freezing up and the unavailability of fuel supply that was coming through the gas pipeline system, and the electric generators that depended on it both had issues with weatherization and freezing that was not planned or expected. That led to the very different circumstance than what was planned for in the days leading up to Winter Storm Uri, and that led to the very negative outcomes of the load shed and everything that followed.
Yeah, and obviously that was a devastating storm in the state's history. At least 246 people died. There were billions of dollars in damages. And it really put a spotlight on the state's power system. If something like this were to happen tomorrow, obviously that would be terrible. But say suddenly the temperature drops to 5 degrees overnight, this cold snap lasts for a week. How does the Texas grid hold up? Is it different than last time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is. It's very different. It's meaningfully different. Right after Winter Storm Uri, the changes that were enacted through the legislature and the Public Utility Commission made significant and meaningful changes to the operations of the grid. The first and foremost one is weatherization. That, I think, has had the biggest impact on the performance of the assets during those extreme weather events, cold or hot. But in addition to that, we also operate the grid a little more conservatively. We call it kind of a conservative operations mode. And what that means is that when we start seeing the potential for scarcity, in case something were to happen in the forecast, and let's say a large generating unit would trip offline, or a wind forecast were to be realized lower than what we expected, we would have more resources kind of in reserve, ready to deploy so that we don't get into a condition where we're in emergency operations or at the worst having to shed load. So lots of changes, you know, policy, operating procedures, new ancillary services, and then of course the weatherization inspections have meaningfully changed the landscape of reliability. So when we get that next winter storm, we're going to be as well prepared as we've ever been to deal with what it brings.
This is a higher pressure situation than ever to add more generation because you're seeing a tremendous amount of load come onto the system. That's obviously a huge challenge for grid operators across the country. What is the single biggest challenge, if you can name one, in keeping up with that tremendous demand at the pace needed while also keeping electricity bills affordable?
Yeah, so the good news about, start with the end there. The good thing about when you have a lot of new load growth come on, that means you've got a lot more customers to spread the cost of the infrastructure to. And so that's a good thing. The challenge is just how fast that some of these resources can come on. I'll give you a couple of examples. And in the old days, you know, by the old days, I mean like 10, 15 years ago, when you would have a large industrial load develop on the grid, it would typically take 3 to 4 years to build a big manufacturing facility. Today, you can build a crypto mining facility in a matter of months, where you could see hundreds of megawatts come online from concept to production in literally a matter of months. Far faster we can develop the transmission to serve it, far faster you can develop the generation to serve it. So the kind of resources, load resources that are coming onto grids today are very different than what they used to be before. And they are very large in terms of the kind of energy consumption that they represent. To give you an example, an AI data center uses far more electricity than a non-AI data center. One company that produces the graphical processing units for AI shipped in one quarter something like 500,000 GPUs to serve AI data centers. Each one of those GPUs uses as much energy as a home does in an entire year. So think about that. In one quarter, one company ships 500,000 new homes effectively of demand that's going to show up in a matter of months somewhere in the US grid. And that's going to happen every quarter, and it's going to scale up as more and more companies are continuing to develop the capability to serve the growth in AI data centers. So the demand growth is going to happen. That's probably one of the biggest challenges, is just the nature of how quickly the load is coming online and what we need to do to be able to be ready to serve it.
We've talked a lot about the different challenges that Texas faces. And like I said at the top, a lot of these are challenges that the entire grid is really facing. So I have to ask, what keeps you up at night?
There's always challenges in every business. I'm just trying to, you know, make sure that I keep our organization focused on, here are the 3 to 5 things we need to do this year to meaningfully move the needle forward in terms of the capabilities we have to enable to support what we're going to need to do next winter and then the summer after. But then I also want to keep my eyes on the horizon 5 to 10 years out and think about, you know, what does this mean? If this kind of growth is happening through these avenues and channels, what does the hydrogen economy look like? Is that going to materially change the growth of demand in Texas? What does, you know, the fact that there is so much data center load look like? Will certain, you know, appliances and homes become very, very cheap to electrify? And will we see a rapid transition all of a sudden in kind of home appliances or electric vehicles? Those longer term considerations, we need to always be thinking about it. We know that how much we lean on electricity to support every facet of life and business is only getting more and more important and getting, you know, a bigger part of our day-to-day lives. And so knowing that, it keeps me up thinking about how do we make sure we never fall behind, because the pace of the business is not going to slow down. The pace of digitization is not going to slow down. And we want to be ready to match that and be right ahead of it.
Okay, so I have one last question for you, because this is Politico Energy and this is a podcast where we think a lot of policymakers and other folks are listening. If you had to just send a message to policymakers, politicians on something that maybe you think they don't understand or that you wish they knew, what would you say?
Yeah, I probably would start with balance. There's a lot of talk about how do we enable more and more renewables. Renewables are fantastic. They have great attributes that support many facets of electric grid operations, but they have to be balanced with dispatchable and more, I'd say, consistent, steady resources that can also support the growth and reliability that businesses and consumers expect. Right now, as a country, we have been leaning very heavily to incentivizing and developing renewable resources. In Texas, over the last 15 years, roughly 45,000 megawatts of net new renewables have come online in the system. And at the same time, roughly 2,000 megawatts of net new thermal dispatchable resources have come online. That's really imbalanced. We need to, as a society, recognize that reliability is as important as cost efficiency and clean energy support. They have to all be in balance in order for the system to work. And I would send a message to keep that in mind, and that for us to get to our economic goals, you need all of it to work together well, because if any part of that system breaks, it all fails. I don't think anybody wants that as an outcome.
Well, Pablo, thank you so much. You have been so generous with your time, and it was so great to have you on the Politico Energy podcast. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Catherine. It's great having this important conversation with you, and I look forward to doing it again soon.
For more news on energy and the environment, subscribe to our free newsletter at politico.com/power-switch. And subscribe to Politico Pro to read our morning energy newsletter. Some of the music in today's show is composed by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. And that's our show. I'm Catherine Morehouse, and we'll see you back tomorrow.
Support for this program is provided by Chevron, who is innovating to help responsibly meet rising energy demand across their U.S. operations, like at their Gulf of Mexico facilities, which are some of the world's lowest carbon intensity operations, helping supply energy that's affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner. That's energy in progress. Learn more at chevron.com/meetingdemand.